Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. Typically, we begin the podcast talking about Craig's columns in the Florida Phoenix, but some like alternate weekly newspaper, bi-weekly something reached out to Craig for an opinion piece. New York Times asked you to write about Ron DeSantis and the climate. What did you have to say?
Well, I suggest said, as I have said several times in the Florida Phoenix, that he is better than Rick Scott, which is kind of a low bar on dealing with climate change, but nowhere near to the level of Charlie Crist in dealing with climate change. That DeSantis's focus is on strictly on resilience. Resilience being, let's cope with a rising sea level and not do anything about the cause. Mm-hmm. So he's been handing out these, you know, big checks for places along the waterfront to build bigger seawalls, bigger wastewater plants, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And those are all stopgap measures. They're going to need to be replaced as the sea level continues to rise.
They're also all built solutions. It's more concrete. It's more asphalt. It's more development. It's more building. These are not natural solutions. Ron DeSantis is not interested in seagrass beds or mangroves or sand dunes or oyster beds or native plants or planting more trees to mitigate the impacts of climate change and stronger hurricanes and more sunny day flooding. He wants to build the state out of that problem, which you can't, and which I suspect is because he's got so many friends in the building industry.
Well, and as I pointed out in both my Phoenix column and in the New York Times column, he has done nothing to stop the overdevelopment of the barrier islands. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're really trying to deal with rising sea levels, one of the things you need to do is you need to retreat. You need to let the sea come up and take some of those places. And instead, he's been permitting all kinds of new development out on the barrier islands. My Phoenix column this week is about how the evacuation time for Lee County for the coastal high hazard area is 96 hours. That's 4 days.
Yeah,
that's well beyond what state law requires.
Well, and that's something that more and more conversation is getting on Fernandina Beach, Amelia Island, where I live. There is one road south off the island. There is one road off the island the other way west towards Yulee. The more people you put on this island, and those are two-lane roads. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you have an evacuation order and you've got 10,000 or 12,000 or 15,000 or 18,000 people in a matter of hours trying to get out, you have got total gridlock. And that is just one more reason why not to develop these places. But you mentioned a trigger word for conservatives, not conservationists, conservatives, and that's retreat.
They will never retreat.
They will never admit that. No, this land is supposed to be for nature and people should go somewhere else. Retreat is the new global warming for right wingers, and they will stick their chin out and take repeated blows before they admit that, you know what, it's probably not a good idea to build there.
And so my Phoenix column actually starts with Jesus saying, don't build your house on the sand.
I'll have links to the New York Times piece and the Florida Phoenix piece in the show notes. And of course, we are talking increasingly about hurricanes after Hurricane Ian came through. And that reminds us of windstormproducts.com. Windstorm Products, a local family company, started small there down on the Treasure Coast. It's built itself up into the largest online retailer of hurricane hardware. And that's all the wing nuts and the bolts and screws and the drill bits and everything you need to secure your home, business, property, whatever it happens to be. It might be your home. It might be a shed. It might be some sort of outbuilding. Maybe you've got a farm. Maybe you've got a restaurant and you've got a patio and all kinds of stuff you're worried about flying around in the next hurricane. Look up windstormproducts.com. They've got an 800 number there in the upper right-hand corner of the website. They will get you expertise, let you know exactly what you need to order and how much and how to install it. windstormproducts.com. And our guest this week is a topic we've brought up before, music in Florida. We've had episodes on Southern rock and Elvis and R&B, and all of those are in the archives if you're a music lover. But today we're focused specifically on the Allman Brothers.
That's right. Bob Beatty has written this terrific book focusing not just on the Allman Brothers, but on one specific album by the Allman Brothers, their live double album at Fillmore East. say, and I think it's fair to say he's a fan.
Play All Night, Dwayne Allman and the Journey to Fillmore East is the name of the book, University Press of Florida. There's a link to that in the show notes as well. Take it away.
I have to ask, do you celebrate March 23rd the way other people celebrate Christmas?
It's and actually, that's so great question, Craig. March 26th is the date that we celebrate. March 23rd is the day before, you know, before Greg got there. But yes, March 26th is definitely one of those dates. That's a great, great point to raise, the March 23rd being the day that the band, except for Greg, got together in Jacksonville, 2844 Riverside Avenue, at a jam at the communal home of the Second Coming, Barry Oakley and Dickie Betts, pretty much immediately after they called Greg in LA and he was back. By the 26th is the date that they say. And yes, that is a holy date in the Allman Brothers Band catalog. Absolutely, Craig. The great, great call.
Now you came to your admiration, which is kind of a mild word for it, your admiration for the Allman Brothers Band through a kind of a weird process. Can you tell people a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I'll be very quick. You know, you don't grow up in the 70s and 80s, particularly in Florida, and you know not know who the Allman Brothers were. So, you know, they were always around, but for me, where it really kicked in was the greatest hits album called Decade of Hits that I got from the BMG Music Club. Actually, my roommate, Irwin M. Fletcher, my roommate, I always say, and if you're old school like me, you know that is Chevy Chase's character in Fletch. Irwin got the Decade of Hits, and Bob never really stopped listening to, I've never stopped listening to the Allman Brothers since then, in really constant rotation. It just walloped me, in good ways. Here we are 25 years later.
Well, so what was it that appealed to you so much? What hooked you?
I wish I really knew, Craig. It was the sound, and that's the best I can say. It reflected just about everything I loved about music, and it felt very familiar to me. And that's when I broke it down years later and studied it. You know, one way new music gets out there is it's adapting old forms. I would never have thought that. But Dreams was a blues based on a jazz. In some ways, The Vamp is based on Miles Davis, so it's all blues, and it's a ballad. It's got all of these different elements, and it was haunting, and it was beautiful, and it was scary, and it had slide guitar, which from back in the 80s when I heard Muddy Waters doing it, went nuts. It was almost as if at 22 years old, God said, hey, I'm going to let you listen to this, and this is going to be what you're going to be obsessed with the rest of your life. And it's, I'm going to say, honestly, it's safe for you to listen to, and I'll get into that at some other time. But, it was a perfect confluence, Craig, of time, place, space. My mind was really ready for it. I was playing guitar, not very well, and it really inspired me to get better. And as I just kept peeling the onion back, it was just, the story was absolutely fascinating. All of this music was there. And then I got on the bus about the time, just after they had reunited and were in this great, second great revival, third actually revival of their popularity. So it was also very tangible to me. Mm-hmm. The Florida roots, by the way, I want to say for this podcast and for others, like that was big for me. You know, something great, groundbreaking that came out of Florida and in an era I lived.
Statesboro Blues, Ramblin' Man, Midnight Rider, Southbound, Melissa, Whipping Post are some of the songs off that Greatest Hits album that folks will surely recognize if they've ever turned on a radio in the United States of America and listened to music. You talked about the Florida roots. All right, well, let's go there. This is the Welcome to Florida podcast. The Allmans, if I'm not mistaken, born in Nashville. How did they get to Florida?
Mom, so their dad was murdered. Very, both of them were young in a botched robbery attempt. He had survived Normandy, jumped at Normandy, and dies later. And the single mother, Geraldine, basically she moves down to Daytona Beach in sometime in the latter 50s, and that becomes home base for Dwayne and Greg. Dickie Betts is from Palm Beach County originally. Spent a lot of time over in Manatee County, and near Sarasota. And Butch Trucks is from Jacksonville. And Barry Oakley, I say this in the book, I call him a Southerner. He was living in Florida and had adopted the South. He's from Chicago, though, but he had moved to Florida. You know, so I call him a Floridian, just like a lot of us, I shouldn't say us because I'm a native, but a lot of folks in Florida. The story starts there. I wanted it to be really Florida. I hoped it was Florida centric. It's actually not as much Florida. It's a Southern story more than Florida.
So what were the boys like when they were growing up in Florida?
I didn't touch a lot of this in the book because this ground had been really well covered. Dwayne was a Hellion. He was older, apparently. Well, let's just say he was a Hellion, I guess. Okay. You know, Greg was a lot more reserved and followed Greg pretty religiously. That was kind of how their relationship was. Greg said it, you know, for years. They were bitten by the music bug early, and from, you know, really about like 1960 were on 60, 61, et cetera, were just playing music constantly. They pushed the envelope, Craig. They played black music. They hung out with black performers. They went to the other side of town, you know, on the west side of the mainland in Daytona Beach and played black clubs in the evening. Hmm. And really were dedicated to music. And once Greg graduated high school, they took to the road and never looked back, 1965. And a lot of their contemporaries in Florida looked at them as being this, you know, and throughout the South as being successful, as being really dedicated to music in ways a lot of others weren't. You know, musicians start locally, then they move and branch a little further and then a little further. And at each point, musicians also drop along the way, right? So as you go from, I'm going to play Daytona, you know, Beach and up and maybe up to Jacksonville to, I'm going to go into Orlando. Now we're going to also do Pensacola, and that's going to include, you know, Mobile, Alabama. And you know, certain people get tired of that when you're making no money and working in the, you know, in the Chitlin circuit.
Yeah, it's a grind. It's a ton of windshield time, like you said, no money, eating garbage food. But, you know, it's one of those things like, you know, it is being an artist because you're a musician, you're an artist. You can't imagine doing anything else, right? I mean, these are not people that could sit behind a desk. I mean, it's something, yes, that is inside you, and it's damn the torpedoes, whatever the costs of this happen to be to my personal life or health or whatever else, this I have to do. It is inside me and I have to let this out.
They definitely, you know, Dwayne and Greg did that. And when they lost half their band in the Almond Joys, they picked up, you know, Paul Hornsby and Johnny Sandlin, who were Alabamians. So, you know, those guys had lost their band, you know, then they end up, like you said, connecting. And even, by the way, Johnny and Paul Hornsby, both who, you know, were in a band within the Hourglass with them for a couple of years, they didn't want to re-sign. They didn't want to join up with Dwayne again in 1969. Paul Hornsby said, he had more stepping stones and we'd done stepped on those stones already.
now, Dwayne had a chance for kind of a less frantic life. He had a pretty regular gig in Muscle Shoals as a studio musician. Right.
Yeah.
But that didn't satisfy him, I guess.
No, Dwayne. In fact, there's a quote. I'm pretty sure I have it in the book. It's such a great quote of Dwayne's, but he said, "I'm just not the sitting on my ass type." you know, and that was what they said, is you can make five bills a week, play anything you want, drive a Cadillac. And he's just like, no, he missed gigging. Muscle Shoals was a really short time period. You're talking, you know, really about October to February, October 68 to February 69-ish. He was September is when he started there. He's really only a full-time guy there. And through about January, then he and J-Mo leave sometime in February and never look back. But he missed it. He missed playing. It was the only time in his life he was not primary in his adult life, which was short. Mm-hmm. He wasn't gigging.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about J-Mo, who to me is a really intriguing character. They were living together and jamming together frequently.
The soul of the Allman Brothers Band. J-Mo was an R&B drummer, but he was an R&B drummer, but he was a jazz guy at heart. He had been in a bunch of R&B bands, including for a time Otis Redding's band, Percy Sledge's band. And that's where he met Twiggs Linden, who worked for Phil Walden in Macon. I'm throwing a lot of names out at y'all, but Twiggs and J-Mo stayed in touch for years between these gigs. And J-Mo moved to Macon to join up with, at that point, an unformed rhythm section that at what became Capricorn Studios. At that time, it was Redwall Studios Otis Redding, Phil Walden studio. Mm-hmm. And J-Mo goes to Muscle Shoals at the request of, it was sort of everybody encouraged, goes to Muscle Shoals to meet Dwayne. Phil Walden said, you know, hey, we got this guy. He plays so weird. Nobody knows what he's doing. Dwayne, what do you think? And Dwayne's like, what? Are you kidding, man? This cat's burning. J-Mo was a jazz guy. J-Mo was just fixing to quit the whole rock and roll business and starve playing jazz. He shows up in Muscle Shoals and they start playing together and have an immediate connection. J-Mo says, I never thought about anything else ever again. He went to make money. He says his mentor, Honey Boy Edwards, said, you want to make money? Go play with the White Boys. And J-Mo had Dwayne had a contract, a lot of industry backing, and it was an intriguing possibility. But then when they played, it was completely different. They moved in together. You mentioned Craig. I've always thought this was, strange is a weird word to say. I mean, this is 1968, 69 in Northwest Alabama. If you recall, I recall because y'all don't know the story as well. But when Dwayne played on the Hey Jude session, the reason he convinced Wilson Pickett, or the reason he had a chance to convince Wilson Pickett to record it, is because he and Wilson Pickett couldn't go out to dinner in Muscle Shoals. Dwayne was a hippie. Wilson Pickett was a black man. So Dwayne and Greg moving in together in a cabin, you know, in Northwest Alabama is kind of unusual for the time.
For the 60s,
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Muscle Shoals and that those studio musicians, you know, there are numerous documentaries and books and stories told about them and the Wrecking Crew and how they played backup, you know, instruments for literally the biggest acts in the world, bar none. They are featured in all kinds of movies, and it's this, very out of the way place, Muscle Shoals, Alabama. It still is, let alone 50 years ago. So, but Dwayne Allman is there, and like you said, you know, there is some stability there. They've got the biggest acts in the world coming through there. This is unusual for, and you know, he's in his early 20s, and this is security for a musician. What was it about getting back on the road that appealed to him over this incredible job of you know, backing the likes of Aretha Franklin and everyone else in the world who came through Muscle Shoals?
It's a good question. I think one is Dwayne was too restless to sit still. I think that's an absolute fact. And, you know,
rambling man.
Yeah. And you know, whether it's a Dickey song or not, it's true. And if you listen to the songs that they do, Midnight Rider, again, not Dwayne's song, but it sort of talks about that. Melissa is a song about that. So I think that's the first part. I think the other part is, you know, Dwayne quit doing sessions pretty quickly after he formed the Allman Brothers Band. He still did some. It was money. But he stated, you know, he preferred to work as a part of the band rather than as a hired session guy. Mm-hmm. So when he got a little bit more notoriety, or that's probably the wrong word, but some more wiggle room, I guess, with Delaney and Bonnie, with Clapton on Layla, he enjoyed that stuff, but he just wanted to do his own thing. I'm pretty convinced of that. It says it very clearly. Studio work is great, and he did get to let loose, but not to the extent, you know, that he does. And he handpicked the six guys, you know, the other five guys in his band.
Well, you mentioned his vision. He had a vision for what he wanted to hear. Yeah.
And Craig, I've talked with Alan Paul about this, who wrote pretty much the definitive biography of the Allman Brothers Band, The One Way Out, that came out in 2014. And it was one of the first questions we both discussed was like, what would you ask Dwayne? You know, and mine's the same as him. Like, did you have the sound in mind, or did the pieces fall in place and then say, oh, this is the sound in mind? And I'm guessing it's, you know, from my limited experience, you know, I do play music. I'm not a professional musician. You know, but in these things, you know, I had an idea for this book until I started writing it, you know, and it's changed, at least. And by the way, I continue to think about it, how it's changed, and my understanding has changed. So he had a vision for something. That vision required more than just Greg. You know, mm-hmm. and so he added pieces to the mix, J-Mo and Barry Oakley being kind of the first two. And J-Mo, Barry was still in a band, so J-Mo was the first guy that officially joined on.
The new book, as we mentioned previously, Play All Night, Dwayne Allman and the Journey to Fillmore East. Okay, let's bring in Fillmore East. This is a 1971 live album recorded at this music venue in New York. Why was this and is this so important to the story?
Well, especially compared to their previous album.
Yeah, yeah. This is something I, as a historian, not as a fanboy. Okay, so if you read my preface, I start out up front because I was like, I can't get past this. Y'all are going to know regardless. So as a historian, I actually had to look at those first two albums, you know, in the manner in which they were done, and look at Fillmore East, not as a concert recording, but as a live album. So I'll sort of break it down a bit. The first album was Rushed, the debut album. It has what I think is Dwayne's finest studio cut, studio solo, which is Dreams. I mentioned earlier. I mean, I've listened to that song more times than I can count. It didn't hit. And then they released Idlewild South the next year, and it was it's ethereal. It's a good record. It's kind of surprising it didn't hit because the sound was good. Almost every reviewer said it's good, but it ain't seeing them live. Some point in that year, 1970, 71, they're like, look, we got to record a live album. And it was a go for broke situation because they were going to break the band up. That was always the discussion. Phil Walden had spent a lot of money on them and they were not returning dividends.
Who's he, like the label guy?
Thank you. He was the founder of Capricorn Records. He was manager of the band. He ran their publishing operation and he ran their booking.
Conflict of interest at all.
I was going to say, if you think that conflicts, yes. And it caused problems later.
Yeah.
But he had a partnership with Atlantic Records with Jerry Wexler, who sent Aretha down to Muscle Shoals and Wilson Pickett and that. That's who kind of made the decision to make the live album. They had to be heard live. And it's clear.
So he's got all this money into the Allman Brothers and sending them around and producing records and nothing has caught on. And that's why it's either we're going to do this live thing and try and capture this incredible magic they have on the stage or.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what it was. It was, and there was the intention. I don't think they went in thinking they were going to do a double album, but the quality of the material was such that they did.
How did they pick that venue?
There's some talk. It was the logical venue. They were at one point talking about the Warehouse in New Orleans, which has long since closed, where they played some legendary shows over the years. It's actually where the Dead played the night they got busted. In the song Truckin' down in New Orleans, down on Bourbon Street. But I think it was Bill Graham and the quality of the operation that he ran. The sound was excellent. The staging and lighting were excellent. The crowd was always, New York has always been an Allman Brothers town. So I think it wasn't the no-brainer it looks like in hindsight, but it was kind of a no-brainer. It wasn't quite the no-brainer at the time as it looks like in hindsight, I should say.
Is there a recording of this?
Oh, that's a good question.
No. Yeah, not that I know of. There's like a snippet from silent film that a friend of mine, rest in peace, Jules Fothergill, synced up. Where you can actually see Dwayne like wailing. It's not great, but it kills me. Kills me. So little video of Dwayne Allman. So little video.
Just generally, huh? Even beyond, because in 1971, yeah. I mean, it's early. There's no camera phones. It's not like 7,000 people in the stands have a camera. Yeah. But you know, you think of the band the video by this time is certainly not
Beatles. The Beatles is
sure
their video of great jazz artists from the 50s, you know, Thelonious Monk and so forth. But one thing I was intrigued by, and I had not thought of this, is the role that AM versus FM radio played in making this album a hit.
So that's a huge sub story that involved that really could go really long discussion. It's just quickly for today's audience. Back in 1970, the main radio band was AM radio. It's a very powerful signal, and everybody listened to it. That's where the hits were. FM was this other channel, higher fidelity, lower range, or higher sound fidelity, lower range. But what happened was and I wish I had the date, but at some point in this era, the FCC said what happened was radio stations owned FM and AM in the same place, and they would just simulcast their AM broadcast on FM. The FCC said you can't do that anymore. And really, FM became the the radio band of the hippies, the heads, you know, the the music lovers, and the DJs would put a 22 minute Mountain Jam on, go out and smoke a joint, go to the bathroom and come back and, you know, talk. So it, at Fillmore East broke on FM radio. Everybody will say that because FM would play these longer album cuts. AM still stuck to the 3 minute format, and the Allman Brothers just, most of their songs are longer than that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. In general, even their short songs are longer than a 45 minute, you know, 45 single.
Wow. What did this do for the band, the success of this album?
Two things. One is it propelled them to absolute superstardom immediately. It hit gold within like 6 weeks, selling 500,000 copies. That's, you know, tremendous considering they hadn't moved, I don't think, 100,000 combined in their first two records. And mm-hmm. if they had, it was barely over that. Dwayne died right after that happened, October 29th, 1971. The band... it was one of the most remarkable things ever. I did a whole chapter on this. I will speak on this until people tell me to shut up, because they went out as a quintet and played a whole bunch of dates they had scheduled. They finished the Eat a Peach album without Dwayne. It's some of the most, the music from that tour is stunning because there's a hole, you can hear it, and they're playing to cover it, and you can feel they're playing through their grief. It's pretty incredible. Barry Oakley died almost exactly a year later in a very similar, in a motorcycle accident in a similar spot in Macon. And they grabbed at that point, Chuck Lavelle and Lamar Williams on bass, Chuck on piano. And then they recorded at that point, Brothers and Sisters finished that, which became they were the number one band in the land from 73 to 75 ish.
And then they broke all that adversity again, two yeah. band members dying in motorcycle crashes, almost a year apart, both in Macon. I mean, it's amazing, and looking, you know, through your book and stuff online, I didn't realize Dwayne Allman was 24.
Yeah,
24. That, I mean, of course, you know, everyone in that era looked so much older because of the long hair and the face. I would have thought for sure he was 28, 29, 30, 24. I mean, that just it's astounding. He did so much and had such a vision and is such a giant at that age. Amazing.
Yeah. I say the same thing, and it's, you know, I was 22 when I discovered them. So I was listening to music made by people my own age. Mm-hmm. And it's funny now that you say that, and Craig asked, like, how did I get started? I'm guessing that might've had something to do with it. If I can go way back there in my memory banks, his recording credits. He has a 7-disc box set that his daughter Galadriel did, all between, like, you know, teenage to 24 years old. And this is across the board, not just Allman Brothers stuff. Mm-hmm. It is an yeah. astounding legacy. And you know, Craig, you asked the question. I think the number one thing is his legacy is not at Fillmore East. That's why we remember the band, because if they mm-hmm. didn't break through there, we might not. His legacy is the band outlived him by 43 years and really yeah. stuck to that formula, even mm-hmm. when they screwed up on that formula with the keytar and the 80s and stuff like that. That's pretty incredible to me.
What are some bands today that sort of carry on that sound, that vision?
What a great question. Tedeschi Trucks Band, Jacksonville's own, is the mm-hmm. one band. You know, I don't go to them expecting to see an Allman Brothers concert. I go there watching to experience a band that plays with the same verve, the same spirit. There's no doubt in my mind, although I've never had any discussions with Derek Trucks about this or Susan Tedeschi, but there's no doubt in my mind they're very influenced by that, you know, that first aesthetic. Other bands that I love now, I don't know if they're necessarily carrying in the tradition. I do think Southern rock writ large sort of ends as a genre, as ends in popularity sometime in the early 80s, about the time MTV goes up. So you really can't call, like, Drive-By Truckers classic Southern rock like this. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, Americana now, which is kind of what it's morphed to.
Right.
But they don't jam.
They do pay tribute to the Southern rock. They have a whole album about Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yeah, their first big album. And mm-hmm. you know, they're talking, though, about, you know, that era of Southern mm-hmm. rock that we all grew up in and they grew up in. But they're very much cut from that cloth. I'd say the Avett Brothers are, too. I'm naming all all mail bans because my mind is a little stuff.
Well, I think you could, you know, for me, I'm more of a country person than a rock person. So you say, you know, Southern rock kind of ended in the 80s. That's where I think country music picked up a lot of it in that era. Dwight Yoakam, Steve Earle, you know, Linda Ronstadt obviously predates that. I think you can find some there. Emmylou Harris, you know, there are a lot of those younger country. Yeah, for sure. Travis Tritt in the that came up in the mid to late 80s that for sure were influenced. I think Alabama would obviously be, you know, cite the Allman Brothers as an influence, but those 1980s, you know, major and younger country acts that picked up that baton of Southern rock and took it to country music. That's where I hear a lot. And granted, they're not on the radio anymore. So that's where, you know, I hear that next generation of Allman Brothers music.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, you know, Chris Stapleton, Marcus King. I want both of them desperately to cover Chris Stapleton, Marcus King. Please listen to this podcast and cover a Greg Allman song. Eric Church, seriously, on the Greg Allman tribute, he covered Greg's Win, Lose, or Draw, covered the Allman Brothers Win, Lose, or Draw. I can't tell you how many times I've listened to it. It's incredible. And what you said, Chad, is an important point. I don't think there's a back in the 90s when I first discovered the Allman Brothers. And I always use those quotes because, again, I didn't discover them. You weren't hearing a lot of guitarists talk about or musicians talk about the Allman Brothers influence. Now it's you hear it a lot. Jimmy Chamberlain, the drummer of the Smashing Pumpkins, and I have struck up a couple conversations, hugely influenced by the Allman Brothers. When I found the Allman Brothers, I was listening nonstop to the Smashing Pumpkins in the early 90s. So when he told me that, I was like, oh my, wait.
Now it makes sense.
Allman Brothers now influence this kind of psychedelic music too. Holy, I don't know if I can curse here. So holy crap. You know, and I'm still unpacking that now. You know, it was like when I discovered, they always said Kind of Blue was this huge influence on the Allman Brothers. So I got Kind of Blue, you know, and I was like, I don't hear the Allman Brothers in this. Well, no, you got to listen to Fillmore East to hear the jazz inherent. Yeah. And you got to listen to it a lot. It's not
Kind of Blues, you know, Miles Davis, right?
Yes, kind of. Yes, yeah. Miles Davis.
You have to hear the connections.
Yes, and you really got to do it. You got to do it the right way. So now I listen to the Pumpkins trying to hear the Allman Brothers rather than the Allman Brothers trying to hear the Pumpkins, and, you know, vice. It's just...
Well, that's, I think, one thing that's so exciting or interesting about musicians. You know, their influences are so varied. You talked about the Allman Brothers, you know, growing up and engaging on that Chitlin' circuit where, you know, they would have gotten, you know, Ray Charles and James Brown and Cab Calloway and a lot of that kind of material. You know, if you are a musician, you know, kind of game respects game, right? And regardless of what instrument you're playing or which radio station, well, you're on the black radio station, so I can't listen to you, or you're on the Opry, so I can't listen to you, or I'm on the Opry and I'm not plugging in, or you're not doing this and I'm not electric and you're not, you know,
you got it.
Artists don't go along with all of those, like, music industry walls. And it is astonishing when you really dig into some bands and you find out the what are seemingly odd inspirations that they have.
Yeah. This has been great. Thank you so much, Bob. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate y'all. If I could do a plug for my social media accounts, is at Long Live the ABB. And that's only just to let people know I'm having conversation about this all the time. It's a lot of fun. I hope you guys enjoy the book and you find a lot, y'all, you guys, I'm saying you too, but also your audience. I spent a lot of time on this, and I really appreciate you guys asking me, Craig. I've been a big fan of your stuff for a long time. Thank and you. You're for my home state, the Sunshine State of Florida. And last thing, I'm now officially a Florida Gator, 33 years after going to UCF instead of Florida. And, this is also the year my youngest daughter joined my oldest daughter at the University of Tennessee. So the year I become a Gator, my daughter's officially become Tennessee Vols. I don't know how conflicted I am about that, but anyway.
Well, they got you this year, but you've had the upper hand, or the Gators have for many, many years.
I'm happy for my daughters, I got to be honest with you.
Play All Night, Dwayne Allman and the Journey to Fillmore East, just released through the University of Press of Florida. Bob Beattie, thanks you so much for joining us today.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Are you an Allman Brothers fan, Craig?
I was a big jazz fan when I was a kid because of my grandmother. She introduced me to big band and swing and that kind of went on from there. But when I got to college, I had a couple of roommates who sort of schooled me in rock and roll. And one of them was a guy from Macon, Georgia, who, of course, was a huge Allman Brothers fan. And I didn't realize until I got much older, hey, that's a Florida. Those are Florida guys.
Yeah.
This is great. And I'm glad he mentioned the Tedeschi Trucks Band. I'm a huge fan of them. I actually saw them in concert in 2018.
Yeah, they play all the time still.
Oh, yeah. The only thing wrong with that concert was that it ended.
Before we go, wanted to mention we started off talking about Craig's opinion piece in the New York Times. The latest issue of Flamingo Magazine is on the stands, but Craig and I both have pieces in there. Yours, Craig, about billionaires in space, right?
Yes, space. You have to say it that way. Space.
Mine is about the first Black-owned bourbon brand in Florida, Fort Mose Bourbon. So pick up a copy of Flamingo Magazine on the newsstand or check it out online. Florida's premier and really only statewide lifestyle magazine. A great one. And welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.